beginning of Parshas Pinchas, alongside everything else that is happening, there is the aftermath of the Maisa Zimri, the reward of Pinchas, and most of the beginning of the Parsha is actually taken up with the counting of Bnei Yisrael. This is their final counting, the end of Bamidbar, just before they go into Eretz Yisrael. But there is also a directive, which is mentioned over the course of one or two psukim, and that is that there will be a certain aggression targeted against the Midyanim. That is to be found in Perek Kafhei, Pasuk Tet Zayin, Vayidaber Hashem Moshe Lemor, Tzoros HaMidyanim, harass the Midyanim, antagonize them, Bikisam Osam, and strike them, Kitzorim Hem Lachem, for they are harassing you, with their designs and plans that they plotted against you in the matter of Pa'or, and also with regards to Cosby, who was the Midianite princess, as a result of the episode of Pa'or, and specifically the involvement of Cosby, there is an instruction that the Jewish people are to wage their own campaign against Midian. What's interesting is, although it is communicated here as an instruction, the follow-up and the actual implementation of this campaign will not be until next week's Parsha. Nekom es nikmas b'nei Yisrael me'es ha-Midyanim, which is in Perek Lamed Aleph. It's very interesting, therefore, why, given that we will be told again when the time comes exactly what to do, nonetheless there is something of a prelude to this campaign which is mentioned and then put to the side as the Jewish people are counted. Interestingly, the word saror, we translated saror as harassed, not to get too much bogged down in the correct translation of the word sorer. It's from the word tsar, enmity, antagonism. But the grammatical construction of the word saror, it's actually not an instruction at all. For the instruction would be tsiror, with the shiva. Rashi comments on the word saror, kumo zachor shamor. It's very similar in its construction to the word zachor and shamor that we're much more familiar with. And Rashi explains, lashon hoveh, they are actually a form of a present tense. They're not exactly present, but the point is that they aren't really grammatically defined at all. And because they're not defined, there is no defining them in terms of time. Rather, they are ongoing. It is true, contextually, they will take the form of an instruction. But you have an interesting blend of a word that in context must be an instruction, but in terms of grammar is not really an instruction. It's not an imperative, but it's an ongoing form. And the result of all of that is an instruction to harass them on an ongoing basis. And interestingly, Rashi here is consistent with his treatment of this type of word in all situations. On the very word zachor in Parshas Yisro, which of course, it's a mitzvah, zachor v'shamor. Everyone knows that zachor is a mitzvah. And we also know from the Talmud that the mitzvah of zachor is the mitzvah of Kiddush. Zachor is Yom HaShabbos L'Kadsho. But Rashi does not explain that way. Rashi, whose first priority is to explain Pshuto Shel Mikra, explains the word Zachor as a reference to remembering Shabbos, not on Shabbos, but throughout the week. A famous comment of Rashi, at any point in the week, if you see something nice, set it aside for Shabbos. What would cause Rashi to veer from the halachically accepted understanding of Zachor as Kiddush? But the answer is this very point. Because Zachor is in this type of ongoing, infinitive, unqualified way, as much as it's a mitzvah, but the mitzvah itself is ongoing. It's not limited by time. And what that means is it's not limited to Shabbos, but rather it applies the whole time, any time, during the course of the week. And similarly here, Tzoros HaMidyanim is a reference to, literally we translated as harassing the Midianim. But when you put it into its, what it's mashmo'o, it is an instruction. And that is why there is no conflict, certainly as far as Rashi is concerned, between what would otherwise be perceived as soror in the singular to the words which follow, vihikisem osam, which is in the plural. It doesn't say soror vihikisa, or tsararu vihikisem. Is there an issue of a shift from singular to plural? Not at all, because tsaror is not a singular in the first place. That would be, as we said, tsaror. Tsaror is a reference to ongoing harassment. No one has been addressed specifically yet. It is entirely the Jewish people as an entirety with the words vihikisem osam in the plural. So that's just in terms of Lashon HaKodesh. But the questions that we need to ask, it's one question, but in a sense it splits up into two. For the Pasuk here unequivocally targets the Midyanim. Soror es ha-Midyanim. And the first wave of the question is, why should the Midyanim as a people be targeted? And the background to the question is, as far as we understand, their participation in the disaster of Baal Peor was marginal. We only know of it to be represented by one person, that's Cosby herself. But the Midyanim as a people, how do we know that they were involved to the extent that they should now be subject to harassment as a nation? And the second part of the question is not only why are the Midyanim being targeted, but why are only the Midyanim being targeted? As if to say, we refer to the episode of Baal Peor as the episode of Benos Moab. I mean, there were thousands and thousands involved, and they are conspicuously absent here. The targets are Midyanim and not Moavim. What happened to Moab? So Al Rishon Rishon, to see how the classic Mefarshim respond to these questions, we'll take the approaches of Ramban and Rashi. The Ramban states that it seems that with regards to Midyan, we say that only Cosby was involved. It seems that that is not entirely the case, but rather that Midyan were the force behind the idea of Baal Peor. As if to say, what Moab does is as a result of the recommendation and the guidance of Midyan. It's interesting to note that this relationship between Moab and Midyan can already be perceived in the beginning of last week's Parsha. Because when Moab sees the Jewish people, Vayar Balak ben Sippor, and they're coming, and he doesn't know what to do, and he's alarmed and afraid, the first people he turns to, or Moab turns to, are the Midyanim, as the Pasuk says explicitly. Vayome Moab el Midyan, el Zikne Midyan. They're going to uproot us. What are we to do? And that message was originally sent to Midian. And the follow-up to that is a delegation to Bilam, which we spoke about last week, which comprises initially of Zikne Moab and Zikne Midian. It seems that Midian have this advisory capacity to Moab. When Moab have a problem, they'll turn to Midian, and Midian will help them out. And this role of Midyan in the plotting of Baal Peor is really explicit in our Pasuk, but we just have seen the background a little bit. The Pasuk Yud Ches states, Ki tzorim hem lachem, they are harassing you. How are they harassing you? We haven't heard from them. We didn't see them actively involved. The Pasuk continues, B'nichlehem, nichalim are plots and designs. They are the ones who plotted Asheniklu Lachem or Devar Peor. So Devar Peor was executed by Benos Moab, but it was planned by Midyan. And thus, they are also sharing in the culpability. Now, it is true, says Ramban, that later on, as we return to Parshas Matos, we will see that there's an individual who is implicated as the one behind the idea of Baal Peor, and that is Bilam himself. That was his parting gift to Balak when all of his curses failed because they turned into blessings. He caused more damage with that piece of advice than he could do with any of his curses. He said, if you get them involved with Benos Moab, with your daughters, there'll be a disaster. And indeed, the pasuk says, as we know, "Hein hein hayu bidvar Bilam." So Bilam is named as the one who's behind the idea of Baal Peor. Says Ramban, that is not a contradiction. For when we say that Bilam is behind Baal Peor, on the contrary, it seems that Bilam together with Midian are working as a team. For as we see, the end of Parshas Balak describes Bilam as leaving. He went home. But the next time we see Bilam, he's not home. He's in Midian. He had the misfortune of getting caught up in the battle between Yisrael and Midian, and that's where he was killed. There's Bilam ben Beor, Hagur b'Chareb. So what was he doing in Midian? As far as we know, he went home. Home, as we said last week, is Pesorah, Aram Naharaim. What's he doing in Midian? Except it seems that he was operating out of Midian. And therefore, when he left the vantage point of where he was cursing Bnei Yisrael from, and it says he went back to his place, that means he went back to his base of operations, which is Midian. It was his bad mazel, and that's where the battle took place, and he was killed there. And so we see that in an advisory capacity, and very often the ones behind the ideas are the ones who are most guilty, because without a good plan, muscle can only take one so far. And thus the pasuk says, as the plotters behind Baal Peor, Saror es Hamidyanim. There is a further point. We say that in terms of active participation, there was only one Midianite involved, and that's Cosby. Says Ramban, that's easier said than done. In other words, if you're talking about, as the pasuk describes her, she is a princess of Midian, see, she's not just someone from the street. Someone that high up who gets involved and who forms an alliance with the Jewish people, that means that there are plans of this nature being generated from the highest levels of Midian. If one of their princesses is the one that gets involved. And so, should we ask, Sororis HaMidyanim, what did they do? The answer is, plenty. They are the ones behind the idea of Baal Peor. But that only explains why Midian are in terms of Sororis HaMidyanim. But why is Moab out, after all? Whatever you can say about Midian, however, we will show that they were also involved. But without Moab, nothing would have happened. Moab were certainly more involved. And here we see the approaches amongst the Mefarshim, in a sense, split up into two pathways. There are those who concur that indeed the Moavim were as much, if not more, culpable than the Midianim, but there are external mitigating reasons why they are not to be targeted here. That's one approach. And the second approach is actually to understand how the role of the Moavim ultimately was less sinister than that of the Midianim. And let us see examples of both of those approaches. Rashi himself, on the words Soror es HaMidyanim, back to Pasuk Yud Zayin, comments, on Pasuk Yud Ches, explains, Ve'es Moav lo tziva lahashmid. Moav was not targeted to be destroyed or attacked. Why? Says Rashi, and this is from the Gemara in Baba Kama, Daf Lamed Ches, Mipnei Rus, Shehoisa Sida Lotzeis Mehem, Kedarminan Bebaba Kama. It's because of one person who in the future would come out from the nation of Moab, whose existence vouchsafes the entire nation at this stage. It's unbelievable. Al Shem Ha'asid. In order to allow Rus to exist and come and join the Jewish people, the entire people of Moab are off limits. I mean, one begins to wonder, could one not have identified the specific individual who will be the progenitor of Rus? And presumably it's one person in that generation. Apparently, that's not the way these things work. And therefore, for Rus to become part of the Jewish people, and ultimately Rus is Ima Shel Malchus, from her will come the Mashiach, that's an overriding concern, and therefore Moab artificially are left alone. But it's not because they don't deserve it, there are other concerns here. Amazingly, as much as Rashi demonstrates the saving grace of Moab to be in the future, Ramban identifies it as being in the past. What's the past of Moab? The past of Moab is Lot. Now, we have a very lukewarm relationship with Lot, but as is often the case, whatever the ultimate verdict will be about a person, credit where credit is due. And now, says Ramban, there is something that you cannot take away from Lot, and that is, he followed Avram from Aram Naharaim to the middle of nowhere, because HaKadosh Baruch Hu told Avram to get up and go, and Lot says, I'm coming with. This is one of the nisyonos of Avram. What that means is Avram did not have a subsidized apartment waiting for him in the heart of Jerusalem when he came to the land of Israel. There was very little there. It was a difficult trip to undertake into the unknown, and Lot says, I'm going with. Says Ramban, if we formulate that, we will come to the unavoidable conclusion that Lot, in his way and to his degree, was Moser Nefesh for Eretz Yisrael. He took a perilous journey into the unknown because he's on the way to Eretz Yisrael. He stuck with Avram, and therefore, says Ramban, until further notice, Lot's descendants have a holding in Eretz Yisrael, which cannot be taken away from them, even as their behavior in future generations leaves much to be desired. And therefore, as we said, Ramban in principle agrees with Rashi that on this occasion, Moab were equally culpable. But in terms of outside factors that will somehow take them off the radar, for Rashi it's Rus in the future, and for Ramban it's Lot in the past. But there is a second approach. And interestingly, it's also to be found in Rashi. Not here, but later on, next week's Parsha, in Parshas Matos. For in Perek Lamed Aleph, Pasuk Beis, and this is where the battle actually happens, where the campaign is initiated, the Pasuk states, Vayedaber Hashem el Moshe le'mor, Nekom Nikmas b'nei Yisrael me'eis ha-Midyonim, exact the vengeance of the Jewish people from Midyon, Achat Yasef al-Amecha, and then you, Moshe, will pass on. Rashi comments, Me'eis ha-Midyonim, from Midyon, Velo me'eis ha-Moavim, again, this glaring question, Midyon only, not Moab. Why? Says Rashi, amazingly, Shehamoavim nichnasu ladavar machmas yira. You cannot compare the wrongdoing or the aggression against the Jewish people on the part of Moab to that of Midian. Moab saw themselves as being under threat. They see the Jewish people, as the pasuk opens, Vayar Balak ben Zippor, Esa Sheisrael Emori. They saw what had happened to Sichon and Og. As far as they're concerned, they're next. Whether they went about it in the right way and whether their concerns were even founded is another question. But certainly from their perspective, they are defending themselves in the only way they feel to be effective. Machmas Yira, Shehayu Yirei Mehem. Right, the Jewish people were already showing signs of aggression to a degree against them. Aval Midyonim, Midyon was in no such imperiled position. They were not in the line of advance of the Jewish people. What's their involvement? Nisabru al Riv lo lohem. They got involved in a fight which had nothing to do with them. They weren't defending themselves. They saw it's the Jewish people. They are possibly a potential target for us if we take advantage of it. Says Rashi, the issue of intent here is decisive. If you're defending yourself, you may be wrong, but that itself is a mitigating factor. Midian were not defending themselves, and therefore the nekama, the issue of vengeance, is against Midyon. Their enmity against the Jewish people was quote-unquote purer and more insidious than that of Moab. Interestingly, and Rashi goes on to give the other perush there in Parshas Matos about Rus, And that now becomes a Rashi question for further discussion. Why is it that the very same question, ostensibly, namely, why Midian and not Moab, is met with one answer in Parshas Pinchas and two answers in Parshas Matos, and that's something we'll have to deal with on another occasion. I have to say, I found a very startling response to this question in the writings of the Kli Yakar, namely, again, why Midian and not Moab, and he takes us back to the scene of the crime, to Perek Kafhei Pasuk Aleph, to the setting of Baal Peor. This is the end of Parshas Balak. Says the Pasuk, Perek Kafhei Pasuk Aleph, Vayeshev Yisrael v'Shittim, Yisrael, they settled in Shittim, Vayochel Ha'am Liznos El Benos Moav. And the nation began to act immorally, znus, with the daughters of Moab. Now, there's a lot to be said about this rather specific phraseology of they began to act immorally. They began and didn't finish. I mean, they did act immorally. That seems to be something of a euphemism. They started to be immoral, and they went through with it. Why does the Pasuk not say, in a somewhat straighter line, Vayeshev Yisrael v'Shittim, Vayiznu Ha'am im Benos Moav? What is the connotation of Vayochel Ha'am Liznos El Benos Moav? Says Kli Yakar, it seems that what the Pasuk is saying is, when it says that they started, it's because they started. In other words, there was too much initiative in this terrible disaster of Znus on the part of the Bnei Yisrael. Bnei Moav were there, they were available, but the initiation came on the part of the Am, whoever the Am are, but they're on our side and not on their side. And therefore, says the Kli Yakar, when it comes to issues of Nekama, it's a very delicate question now, because to say exact vengeance on the part of the Jewish people, one can only exact vengeance if one was the victim, and one can only be the victim if one was preyed upon. But the initiative of the Am in that encounter with Benos Moav was too proactive to have them absolutely as the victims, with the result being to take vengeance from Benos Moav. Midian, on the other hand, that was a program that came entirely from them, and their nekama is appropriate. So that's a very shocking, really, explanation of the Kli Yakar. That's his response to Vayochel, words that without a doubt need to be confronted. A very different approach to this question with regards to the war with Midian. And it's interesting because we mentioned that it's split up over two parshas. This parsha is harass them. There is no actual reference to Nekoma in this week's Parsha. It's only in next week, Nekom Nikmas Bnei Yisrael. So it doesn't seem to be entirely the same idea mentioned and then repeated, but rather two different ideas. But if Nekoma is the issue for next week, then what is the war against the very same people about, or the harassing against the very same people about this week? The answer to this question in one of the Rishonim, the Chizkuni, is short and to the point. On the words, Soror es Hamidyanim, harass the Midyanim, says the Chizkuni, Mikan Amru, it is from here the rabbi said, Haba lehar gecha, hashkem lehar go. If someone is trying to kill you, you need to kill him first. Now, this is a well-known statement from Chazal. It makes, of course, perfect sense. Someone is trying to kill you, you've got to kill him first. It's perfectly reasonable. Unless Israel does it, in which case it's entirely unreasonable. But in principle, makes perfect sense. What does it have to do with us? The Chizkuni, with this brief sentence, is giving us an entirely new perspective on the situation with the Jewish people and Midian. How are they vis-a-vis each other? The answer is, Pinchas has just executed a princess of Midian. Now what? Midian are planning reprisals. They're planning a response. Says the Torah, you've got to respond first. as the Pasuk says, which is interesting because when Pasuk Yud Ches says, Ki Tzorim Hem Lachem, they are harassing you, means they are on the way to harass you now. B'nichleim Hashem Iklu Lachem Al Devar Pa'or, not only with what's been done already, but now these words, Va'al Devar Kozbi Vas Nesim Ejon HaChosam, is not a reference to the past, it's a reference to the immediate future. Cosby is a hot issue now. And what happened with her means that they're on the way. And therefore, you need to take the war to them. And this is before we get to issues of nekama. That's going to be next week. So according to the Chizkuni, this is not the same idea spread over two parshas. It's actually a campaign of a preemptive defense. And the next week, we'll get to the issue of nekama. So these are important discussions with regards to these two psukim that seem to be tucked away between Pinchas and the counting. There's much to be discussed there. Now, as we move further into the Parsha, much of Parsha's Pinchas after the counting is really korbanos. It's the korbanos hamusafim. Anyone who has the bar mitzvah Parsha of Pinchas is always very popular on Yom Tov time, because maftir will always come from this Parsha. It's my Parsha, so I'm speaking from experience. Thanks. Now, 21. Now, the first of the, the Mikra'i Kodesh, the special days, more correctly, is that of Rosh Chodesh. That's in Perek Kafches, Pasuk Yud Aleph, Ubroshei Chod Sheikha. And I wanted to speak for a moment about a matter that pertains to Rosh Chodesh in our current experience, temporarily, as we do not have the korbanos, and that is the inyan of Mevarchim HaChodesh, Shabbos Mevarchim. As we know, the Shabbos before Rosh Chodesh, in Shul, we say when Rosh Chodesh will be, and it kind of makes it into a special Shabbos, Shabbos Mevarchim. What's it all about? What are we looking to achieve? It seems, on a straightforward level, we are announcing when Rosh Chodesh is. People should know. It's important. The Luach is a very important work as far as the Jewish people are concerned. You know when Rosh Chodesh is. You know when everything else is. The Birchas HaChodesh, before we get to the announcement, is actually preceded by a long paragraph. It's very beautiful, of course. The Yehi Raton Shetachadish Aleinu HaChodesh Hazeh. And interestingly, in terms of the background of this tefillah, it was not originally restricted to Rosh Chodesh at all. The Talmud tells us in the second parak of Maseches Brachos and Daf Tet Zayin and Daf Yud Zayin that after the 18/19 Brachos of Shmona Esrei, HaMavarech Es Amo Yisrael B'Shalom, at that point Shmona Esrei is finished. The tefillah itself has concluded. And then we say Elokai Netzor, before we take the three steps back. And now we say Elokai Netzor, but the Gemara presents something like 10 or 12 different tefillahs that were said by various Amoraim. Not all of them said Elokai Netzor. One of them is Elokai Netzor, Mar Bar Avashi. But there were other Amoraim, other rabbis of the Talmud, they used to say other things. And Rav, he used to say this, after every tefillah, Shetachadish Aleinu, Sachodish Hazeh, Tovu Levrocha. For us, it became translocated into Mevarchei HaChodesh because we say Elokai Netzor, and therefore we say this tefillah once a month on Shabbos Mevarchim. This is the background, actually, to an interesting minhag that some have. For the conclusion of the tefillah is Chaim Sheyimalu Mishalos Libeinu Latova, that's it, Amen Selah, and that's that. And then someone says when the Molad is. But there are some kehillas that they have a concluding sentence. After the words, Chaim, Sheyimalu, Mishas, Lebeinu, Latova, they add, well, some add, Bischus Tfilas Rav, and some add, Bischus Tfilas Rabim, and some say, Bischus Tfilas Rav, Utfilas Rabim. What is the meaning of these words? They're not to be found in the Gemara. Well, it is true that this is the Tfilah of Rav. Quite true, as we just said. But nonetheless, even as he was the one who formulated this tefillah, when we say people's tefillahs, we don't then conclude by saying in the merit of the person who composed this tefillah, as surely as we do not conclude Elokai Netzor with the words Bizchus Mar Bar Avashi. So what is behind the concluding words Bizchus Rav, and then what's Bizchus Tefillas Rabin? So the accepted approach, which is actually mentioned or arrived at in the Sefer Bnei Yisoschar, one of the classic Hasidic Sfarim, Rav Tzvi Elimelech Shapira of Dinov, he's the forerunner of the Munkacher Hasidim. And the Bnei Yisoschar says that the inclusion of these words came about in the following way. Originally, the tefillah did not have any such concluding words. However, in one of the Sidurim, so someone wrote, as a source, as a reference for where this tefillah comes from. And the reference was, Brachas, Rav. Brachas, Tefillas Rav. Meaning, it's in the Gemara, in Maseches Brachas, it's the tefillah of Rav. And that's how it was. As things progressed, quote unquote, so there are other people who came to printing, and those who are in the printing business, as we know, are not always in the thinking business. And they're in a hurry, and time is money. And therefore, they saw on the side, brachas, it became, what is the meaning of brachas? Tefillas Rav, it doesn't seem to mean anything. And therefore, it changed into bizchus tefillas Rav. Brachas became bizchus. But it's just a ration, a zion, and it's a different word. And then it's bizchus tefillas Rav. And then further printers said, well, bizchus tefillas Rav, why are we mentioning Rav specifically? And they understood that the intention was to be Bizchus Tfilas Rabin. And that is how these words found their way into the Siddur. So says the Bnei Yisoschar. And others concur. What's amazing is that the Bnei Yisoschar goes on to say, and we say it. And I think this is really a product of the Hasidic way of looking at things. Because they have a very, very broad view of how things happen. And as far as the Bnei Yisoschar is concerned, who is as Hasidic as they come, the fact that something happened by accident doesn't mean it wasn't meant to happen. The fact that the way that these words were meant to find their way into the tefillah is because the printer made a mistake, so be it. If the unlettered cobbler and blacksmith can have his contribution to Jewish thought, so then the mistaken printer can also make his contribution. And therefore, the Bnei Yisoschar is entirely unworried that this came about through a misunderstanding. That's just a detail. The fact is, it's here for a reason. And that's why many kehilas of Hasidim, they conclude, Bizchus Tefillas Rav, Tefillas Rabim, and Shul ends just a few seconds later. It's a very interesting enterprise, the understanding of how certain things come to be in the Siddur. And I would like to mention another one or two examples specifically because sometimes it can be mishandled. And a classic example is at the end of benching. Well, as we know, there are two ways that we conclude, depending on whether it's during the week or whether it's Shabbos or Yom Tov. During the week, we say Magdil Yeshuas Malko, to increase Yeshuas Malko. And on Shabbos, we say Migdol Yeshuas Malko. What is between Magdil and Migdol? And the Mefarshim explain, in terms of their sources, by the way, one is from Tehillim and one is from Shmuel Beis. There is an almost identical Shira that is to be found in Tehillim Perek Yud Ches and at the end of Shmuel Beis. It's the Haftarah, actually, for the seventh day of Pesach. And in Ksuvim, in Tehillim, the word is Magdil. There are a number of differences between them. And in Shmuel, the word is Migdol. So now the question will be, why is it more appropriate to say Magdil during the week and Migdol on Shabbos? And there are answers that are given. Migdol is considered to be a more impressive and a higher level, and therefore it's appropriate for Shabbos, which is itself a higher level, as opposed to the relatively lower level of the weekday, which is Magdil. There was one personality, I'm not sure if I should mention him by name because it's a blunder. So I'm not sure if Dovah B'Shem Omro applies here, but he advanced the following theory. Namely, he said that Magdil and Migdol really it's Magdil. Meaning Magdil the whole time. There's no reason to change. So why do we change? I mean, how does that happen? And he suggests that the reason why is that originally there was a note written in the margin of the bencher, where the bencher says Magdil, and then someone wrote in the side, Beis Shin Beis Migdal. Now, Beis Shin Beis means B'Shmuel Beis. In other words, noting that as much as in the benching we say Magdil, but be aware that in Shmuel Beis we say Migdal. A certain amount of time elapsed, and someone who was not in touch with the original person that wrote this saw it on the side of the bencher, and Beis Shin Beis Migdal, he doesn't realize that it's a reference to Shmuel Beis, and he thought that Beis Shin Beis, with that slash at the end, meant B'Shabbos. Therefore, apparently, someone, the bencher, is telling me that normally you'd say Magdil, but Beis Shin Beis, on Shabbos, you say Migdal. And so it was. So let it be written. So let it be done. And that became the origins of changing from the weekday to Shabbos, and of course, what's Shabbos without Yom Tov? And Shabbos and Yom Tov now become Migdal. That's another example of this type of theory. The problem is, it's impossible for two reasons. Number one, he claims that this was a printing error. This difference between the Magdil during the week and Migdal on Shabbos is already to be found in the writings of the Avodah Zarah. Now, the Avodah Zarah is a Talmud of the Torah. That means that he lives in the 1300s. The printing press had not been invented yet. And therefore, you cannot have a printing error if you have no printing. And moreover, there is a second point. The division of Sefer Shmuel into Shmuel Aleph and Shmuel Beis, 1 Samuel, 2 Samuel, is not Jewish in origin. It's from the church. And moreover, it also only happened in the 1500s. For purposes of organizing, mostly for anti-Semitic polemics, but they were organized, and they divided Sefer Shmuel into Aleph and Beis. And therefore, to say that originally the note was Beis Shin Beis, as if to identify Migdal and Shmuel Beis, which then led to the difference in Shabbos and the weekday, is impossible, because that difference already existed before there was such a thing called Shmuel Beis. There was only Sefer Shmuel. So here's an example of perhaps an over-enthusiastic application of this idea. So one needs to handle with care. I will mention, by the way, while we're talking about this, because it is fascinating, and perhaps a third case to offer further perspective, and this is from the Chazon Ish. We say in Kedusha of Shabbos morning, after Kadosh, 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 so then the Kahal says, Oz b'kol Rash Gadol, Adiv Hazak Mashmim Kol, Mislasim Lemasrafim Leumasam Baruch Yomeiru. Or if you're in a Sfardishul, Mishabchim Ba'omrim, all rivers head to the same sea. Now, it helps in these situations not to speak Hebrew, because you will not notice that something is missing, namely a subject. The sentence has no subject. If we go back again, Oz b'kol rash gadol, something's happening, there's a great sound here, Adir v'chazak, mighty and strong, Mashmiim kol, they give forth their voice, Misnasim, they rise up, L'umas serafim, against the serafim, corresponding, L'umasam, baruch, and corresponding to them, Baruch Yamir. Who are they? Doesn't say. Them. Who is them? Says the Chazon Ish, well, we know who says Baruch Kved Hashem Imkomo. We've already been told in the bracha of Yotzeh HaMa'oros, because there, when we have Kodesh once again, and then we say V'ha'ofanim V'chayos HaKodesh. So who is it that says Kodesh? It's the Serafim. That's from the Novi Yishayah, Serafim Omdim Imal Lo. And who then responds to that with Baruch Kved Hashem Imkomo? The Ufanim and the Chayos, Ufanim, Chayos HaKodesh. They are the ones who are referred to in the bracha before Kriyat Shema, and they are the ones being referred to here. Where? Says the Chazon Ish, it seems quite clear to me that when we say Oz B'kol Rash Gadol, the next two words, adir v'chazak, are not where we're originally there. Rather, originally, the words were ofanim v'chayos mashmiim kol. They're ofanim v'chayos hakodesh. Except, in the course of time, very often things become condensed into Rosh Hatevis, into abbreviations, and then reopened inaccurately. And therefore what began as Ofanim V'chayos got condensed into Aleph Vav, and then got reopened into the words Adir V'chazak, and thus were the Ofanim and Chayos deleted from the sentence. It's quite a thing to say. In this instance, says the Chazon Ish, as much as it seems to be quite clear, but if you come to my shul, I will say, along with everybody else, Adir V'chazak, because I think it's right, but I'm not going to argue with the Siddur. So it's interesting how much of this is thought, how much of it is halacha, how much of it is halacha lemaisa, and there are many, many examples, but we will suffice with these three for the time being. Now, to come back to the announcement itself of Rosh Chodesh, what is the goal? What are we looking to achieve? Well, on a simple level, as we said, people need to know what day is Rosh Chodesh. It's very important. However, there is another approach, which is actually quite fascinating, as to what is happening when we announce the Chodesh on the Shabbos before Rosh Chodesh. As we know, Rosh Chodesh only receives its status if it has been sanctified by a Beis Din. And it's got to be a Beis Din with smicha. And when we use the term smicha here, we mean the unbroken chain from Moshe Rabbeinu himself. If there is no Rosh Chodesh, there is no Yom Tov, because Pesach is the 15th of Nisan. But if Rosh Chodesh Nisan never got its Kedusha from a Beis Din, then Pesach doesn't have its Kedusha either. Now, how is this achieved? Well, as we said, you need a Beis Din. But what if you don't have a Beis Din? What has been happening for the last 1,600-1,700 years, where we don't have smicha in that way, we don't have that unbroken chain of transmission? So who is sanctifying the Chodesh? Why is it that in 2 weeks' time it will be Rosh Chodesh? And here there is a fundamental divide between the Rambam and the Ramban. It does not get any bigger. The Ramban explains that what we know as the Luach, and everyone knows exactly when Rosh Chodesh will be. It's really unbelievable. You know for hundreds of years in advance when Rosh Chodesh will be. Who did that? Who instituted, who organized the Luach? Well, we know that it was organized by Hillel. Not the Hillel of which we normally speak, but rather a descendant of his, Hillel the Third, actually. He was of the Amoraim. He was in the times of the Gemara, past the times of the Mishnah, third or fourth generation, I believe. And he is the one who was metaken the Luach. Why did he do that, says Ramban, for two reasons. Number one, everyone needs to know when Rosh Chodesh is. But there's another reason. Hillel was the last of those who had smicha. And smicha was an endangered enterprise at his time. There were many times that it was not only a capital offense to confer smicha, but it needs to be done in Eretz Yisrael, and people were dispersing and scattering. And therefore, Hillel was one of the last of those who had the capacity and the authority to be Mekadesh the Chodesh. And says Ramban, when he organized the Luach, it was not merely to organize it. He was Mekadesh in advance every single Rosh Chodesh that he determined that's when Rosh Chodesh would be. So that is amazing. There could be no Rosh Chodesh without a Beis Din being Mekadesh it. A Beis Din was Mekadesh it. Until further notice, all of our Rosh Chodoshim are courtesy of Hillel the Third and his Beis Din. That is the approach of the Ramban. And of course, it's coming to answer a very difficult question. You don't have a Beis Din. The Rambam, however, has a different approach. This is in his Sefer HaMitzvahs. And the Rambam explains that, and it's part of the Rambam's approach generally to what the Sanhedrin is. The Sanhedrin is a crystallization of the Torah authority of the Jewish people. It is embodied in 70 people. If you don't have it, if you don't have those 70 people, the power is still there. There are no individuals that have it, but it devolves back to the collective power of the Jewish people. That means the Jewish people can, amongst all of them, or those that are halachically connected, they are the representatives of the Beis Din. Or one could say perhaps even the other way around, the Beis Din are representatives of them. And what the Rambam means to say is that when the Jewish people get together and they concur and establish that the following day will be Rosh Chodesh, it is the collective Torah authority of the Jewish people that makes it Rosh Chodesh for that month. Now we should know there's a bit of a discrepancy here, because it seems from the Rambam himself this is only true for the Jewish people in Eretz Yisrael. They are the ones, as surely as the Sanhedrin itself only functions in Eretz Yisrael, it's only the Yishuv in Eretz Yisrael. That's where the Rambam says that when the Torah tells you that these Yomim Tovim are for always, it's essentially telling you that there will always be a Jewish presence in Israel, which there always was. It was often much diminished, but whoever it is, they represent the latent power of the Sanhedrin. For others, it is not restricted to Eretz Yisrael, but rather it is global. And there are those who explain, therefore, the impact of Mevarchim HaChodesh, and when we say Rosh Chodesh, whatever it is, will be on Tuesday, it will be on Wednesday, when the entire Jewish people get together and say that, they are the ones who are giving it the status of Rosh Chodesh. And that's an enormous difference of perspective. Because according to the Ramban, when we say that Tuesday is Rosh Chodesh, that is information. According to the Rambam's approach, it is formation. It is actually bestowing upon it the status of Rosh Chodesh. And some say that is what we mean when we conclude, just before announcing the Chodesh, Chaverim Kol Yisrael. It's nice. All the Jewish people are friends, at least once a month. What is the meaning of this expression, Chaverim Kol Yisrael? It means the Jewish people are getting together. They're acting as a collective here. You need Chaverim Kol Yisrael, because between all of them, you can be Mekadesh the Chodesh. And it's interesting to note that this has implications for the way we're Mekadesh HaChodesh. The minhag is, when Mevarchim HaChodesh, everyone stands. Why? The Magen Avraham, in Siman Taf Yud Zayin, notes the minhag is to stand, and the reason why is because it's like when the Beis Din are Mekadesh HaChodesh. So everybody stands. And that's why we stand. Now, Rabbi Akiva Eger, in his comments to the Shulchan Aruch, looks at this Magen Avraham, and the Magen Avraham says the Beis Din would stand, that's how they make Kaddish HaChodesh, so we stand, says Rabbi Akiva Eger, I don't know what to do, because I've looked through the Talmud, and everywhere I've seen that has bearing on this issue, the Beis Din don't stand when they're Mekadesh HaChodesh. They actually sit. There's Mishnayos about it in the beginning of the third parak of Maseches Rosh Hashanah. Whoever saw the Chodesh, so those that are the Dayanim, they sit down, and the evidence is presented before them, but it's explicit that the Beis Din are sitting when the Mekadesh HaChodesh. So what does the Magen Avraham mean? That because it's Mekadesh HaChodesh, so we stand like they would. They wouldn't. It's a very difficult question. Rabbi Akiva Eger leaves it unanswered. Says Rabbi Moshe Feinstein, in the Igros Moshe, Chelek Aleph, Siman Kuf Mem Beis, it seems to me that the intent of the Magen Avraham is as follows. Actually, the process of Kiddush HaChodesh has two stages to it. As the Mishnah tells us in Rosh Hashanah Daf Kaf Dalet, the Beis Din would say Mekudash, and then everyone else who was present would say Mekudash, Mekudash. That's it. Now, that response is actually derived by the Gemara from Psukim. In other words, it's also part of the Torah process or procedure of Kiddush HaChodesh. The Beis Din make the decision, the Beis Din issue the verdict, and all of those present, it is part of the mitzvah for them to respond. Mekudesh, Mekudesh. It's derived actually from a couple of Psukim, but one of them interestingly, is the Eile Moedei Hashem Asher Tikru'u Osam Mikra'i Kodesh. Mikra'i Kodesh, which is a reference to the day normally, a holy calling or a holy convocation. Mikra'i Kodesh, says the Gemara, means they need to call it Kodesh. Mikra'i. And that's why they say Mekudesh, Mekudesh. It's called Kodesh twice. Ad Kedei Kach. So now says Rav Moshe, which of these two aspects of Kiddush HaChodesh do we in our shul represent? And he takes the Ramban as definitive. As far as the Ramban is concerned, the verdict of what day is Rosh Chodesh has already been decided. Conveying the status of Rosh Chodesh has already happened, according to the Ramban, by Hillel, hundreds and hundreds of years ago. So now the question is, well, is there any room left for us to do anything? The answer is yes. We represent those that hear the verdict and respond. But the difference between those two things, says Rav Moshe, is when the Beis Din were issuing the verdict of Kiddush HaChodesh, they would be sitting down. But everybody else around them who responded Mekudesh, people, anyone who's in a Beis Din, who is not part of the Beis Din, is always standing. And that, says Rav Moshe, is how I understand what the Magen Avraham means to say. We stand like they would stand for Kiddush HaChodesh. The Dayanim themselves would sit, but we're not the Dayanim according to the Ramban. What we are is the Kahal. And our presence is like the presence in the Beis Din, but that is a standing presence. When we say what the Rosh Chodesh would be, that's the other aspect of Mikra'i Kodesh. So the Ramban is the basis for our minhag of standing as far as the Rambam is as far as Ramban is concerned. In fact, one could perhaps now wonder, according to the Rambam, that it seems, or the approach of the Rambam, that we are actually bestowing the status of Rosh Chodesh, so why would we stand? Perhaps we should rather sit. However, something else is going on in Mevarech HaChodesh. Namely, when the time comes to announce the Chodesh, the Chazan takes the Sefer Torah and holds it. And that's interesting. Because why is he doing that? Most of the other things that the Chazan does, I would say almost everything really, he doesn't do a sefer. He doesn't have a sefer Torah in his hand. Why is it that when it comes to announcing which day will be Rosh Chodesh, he takes a sefer Torah? And here, Rav Soloveitchik said something quite spectacular. The Chazan, as we mentioned before, he is about to draw upon the collective power of the Jewish people, and he says, Chaverim kol Yisrael. All Yisrael are united. They're all together. Says our Soloveitchik, there's only one thing that unites the Jewish people. There's only one thing that allows the Jewish people to be Chaverim kol Yisrael, and that's the Torah. And therefore, as the Chazan states, we're all together, he is holding that which allows us to be all together. If we're dedicated to the Torah, we're all together. If not, it's almost impossible to define Jewishness. Almost everything else isn't what holds the Jewish people together. It's not Yiddish theater, and it's not any of those other things, or the Hebrew language. It's the Torah. That's what makes Chaverim kol Yisrael. And it's interesting that those whose Jewishness is defined by extra Torah matters, they may find clashes between other Jews who define themselves similarly, but based on other factors. If one's Jewishness is more cultural, then when it comes face to face with another Jew with a different culture, and his Jewishness is also cultural, so you have two different types of Judaism, and they're not friends. They're not chaverim, because the cultural divide which defines for each one their Jewishness, it actually splits them apart, but they are separated by a common religion. Because none of it is actually rooted in what makes us the Jewish people. The Musaf for Shalosh Regalim, which again is rooted in Parshas Pinchas on the Musafim, so we say Vikariv Pizureinu Mibein Hagoyim Unufutzaseinu Kanis Miyakasei Aretz. To gather our scatterings and to gather that which has been dispersed. What is the difference between Pizureinu and Nefutzaseinu? Rabbi Shua Leib Diskin said something very thought-provoking. The Jewish people are scattered in more than one way. Being in Golos, being in exile, means that there are divides between the Jewish people of two orders. Number one, they are geographically divided. And number two, they're culturally divided. And one of them is easier to address than the other. Because if you bring them all under one place, so that is the second point. Nefutsosenu kanis meyarkase aretz. From the ends of the world, they can be brought together. That's one thing. But that's not yet kariv pizureinu. There's still a lot which divides them. Because if their personalities and their values and their outlooks are based on cultural differences that are antithetical one to the other, that's a pizur that exists as they all come together. And he is really describing today. Because so many different types of Jews are brought together. And the asset that will allow us to become chaverim kol Yisrael is if we hold the Sefer Torah. Because at the end of the day, everyone's Sefer Torah is the same. And if we're all facing inwards that way, that will help towards Vikarav Pizureinu. And as we know, there can never be too much of Vikarav Pizureinu. We certainly need a great deal more of it. And this is an important part of the lesson and a great deal to think about as we say Mevorachim HaChodesh, especially as the Chazan takes it a little bit on the slow side, plenty to ponder as we prepare for Mevorachim HaChodesh. We'll leave it over there to you.